Welcome to another episode of our NCLEX review series. In this podcast, we continue to bring you valuable materials to help you prepare for your exam. Enjoy.
Third one, umbilical cord. The umbilical cord connects the fetus to the placenta. Now, there have got to be always two arteries and one vein. And after the baby is born and after the umbilical cord has been double clamped and cut, what is your job? To look and see if there are two arteries and a vein. Okay, now the two arteries will be red and the vein will be kind of bluish. You've also got to take a look and see if their Wharton's jelly is present, and Wharton's jelly lies in between the two arteries and the vein. Now the umbilical cord should be approximately the same length as the fetus, though sometimes you have an extra long one or sometimes you have an extra short umbilical cord. An extra short umbilical cord can certainly be a problem because when the baby comes out, it just yanks the placenta right out as well. Okay? And an extra long one can be a problem. Why? Because it can wrap around the baby's neck a few times. All right. During pregnancy, the mommy undergoes several changes, right? She undergoes physiological and psychological adaptations, doesn't she? She undergoes a lot of changes. They occur in all of her systems. They occur in the reproductive system. The breasts get kind of large. The uterus and the cervix and the vagina change also. The uterus grows. The cervix turns bluish, right? And then vagina changes its pH a little bit, and it becomes more mucousy. The cardiovascular system changes. The blood volume increases by 30 to 50%, so a physiological anemia can occur. This is where you've got to tell your patients, you know, that they're going to be, when they do blood work, it may look like they're anemic, but they're really not. It's only because the blood volume has increased. So the blood volume has increased by 30 to 50%. The white blood cells will be increased also. In point of fact, when the baby is born, we draw blood from the mommy, and invariably the mother's white blood cell count will be in the 20,000s. That's normal. That is absolutely normal. We had a neurologist one time whose wife was giving birth, and he was so excited because it was the first baby. We birthed the baby, healthy baby, and everything like that, and then we drew the blood, you know, and her blood work came back at 22,000, her white cell count. Well, since he worked in the hospital as well, you know what he did? He went on the computer and accessed his wife's blood work. When he saw 22,000, he had a cow, and he called down the stairs, and he said, "She has an infection. What's being done about it? Why aren't you giving her any antibiotics?" Because from the computer, he could also access all the treatment she was getting. Okay? So we're looking at all this stuff. I mean, he's just very, really very upset. So essentially what we said to him was, you know, "Steve, you're an excellent neurologist, but you don't know the first thing about birthing babies. So, you know, this is perfectly normal." And he went, "Normal, it's 22,000. It's normal in mommies that just gave birth. It really is, believe me. "Well, have her OB call me," because he didn't believe us. So we had her obstetrician call him, and he never called back. Her coag factors will increase also. Blood flow to the uterus will be better if you put her on the left side lying position, and the blood pressure generally decreases in the second trimester and comes back to normal in the third trimester. Okay, so that's your cardiovascular system. Your respiratory system. You like my Valkyrie? She's singing. Okay, the mucous membrane vascularity increases, and it causes congestion right up here. Did you all ever notice when you were pregnant you suddenly became very nasal? Yeah, so your vascularity increases right up here, and your diaphragm is displaced. Remember the first trimester, you had the teeny-weeny bladder syndrome, and you were up and down to the bathroom every 5 minutes because there was the baby pushing against your bladder? And then the baby grew, and so he moved up, and now he pushed against your diaphragm, and now you can't breathe? Okay, and then sometime in the third trimester, he drops and he pushes against your bladder again? Okay, and then you got to go through labor of how many hours? Yeah, I did 26 hours of labor. So, you know, what am I trying to tell you? I'm trying to tell you that when your kids misbehave, you need to remind them of everything you went through for them. So, yeah, a little guilt goes a long way. Then you got the renal system. The renal system is when your glomerular filtration rate increases, so you are producing more urine. Well, yes, you are, because you also got baby's waste that you're taking care of. Your glucose threshold drops, and so your insulin demand may increase after the 24th week. Okay? And there is, as I said, increased pressure to the bladder. Your integumentary system changes. Your pigmentation changes. That linea negra, you know, which is that line from your belly button straight down. Anyone had that? Yeah? Yeah, I think most darker-skinned women have that. We get this black line that goes from the belly button all the way down to the suprapubic area. We also have something called chloasma, which is the mask of pregnancy, where your face gets real splotchy, okay? But good news is that it goes away, yeah. And so does the linea negra, that goes away too, yeah. But the striae, also known as stretch marks, that doesn't go away. So that's one other thing you can remind your children of that you went through for them. The musculoskeletal system changes, especially for the women. Your center of gravity alters, right? And we get that nice lordosis. Yes, sway back. Pregnant? Yes, we have that. We have cramping in the calf also. And what is that due to? Well, because hypocalcemia. All right, in the old days, what they used to say is have a baby lose a tooth. Because, yeah, the baby would take the calcium from you and you'd lose a tooth. So in the old days, it would be have a baby, lose a tooth, okay, because they took your calcium away from you. The baby's just, yes, see, one more thing. You've got to make a list of all these things you remind your children of. That you do. Then your neurological system. Oh, this is the best. This is when the big, you know, you're used to being carrying a certain amount of weight around, and all of a sudden you've got this protuberance in front of you. And this protuberance is now pushing on everything. It's pushing on your bladder, it's pushing on your arteries and your veins, it's giving you varicose veins, okay, and it's also pushing on your sciatic nerve in the third trimester. I mean, that's painful. And so that's what you kind of look like, right? Or that's what you feel like. Your GI system changes. In the first trimester, talk about nausea and vomiting and fatigue. Nausea and vomiting and fatigue. You cannot keep anything down and you're tired all the time. I used to fall asleep on the floor. Literally, I would go to my friend's house, I'd be talking, all of a sudden I'd be laying on the floor, falling, I'd be asleep. They'd call my husband and say, come get your wife. You know, she's asleep on the floor again. I mean, it was really embarrassing. Oh, dear. One time I went to one of my friends who had a store, she had a shop, she had an arts and crafts shop. I fell asleep on the floor. Yeah, I know. I mean, you know, customers coming in, I'm asleep on the floor. Oh, well. Gums, your gums start to bleed because of the increased vascularity, again, you know, by around your, in your mucous membranes. And your peristalsis can decrease, so you can end up with some form of constipation or gas or heartburn, particularly in the first trimester. It tends to ease off in the second and in the third trimester, but particularly in the first. Your endocrine system also changes. Your FSH level drops, and why? Because your endocrine, your exocrine, estrogen level is way high, your LH level also drops, but your Pitocin levels go up, especially during labor and delivery, because remember Pitocin, or oxytocin rather, same thing, Pitocin is oxytocin, your oxytocin levels go up, and why? Especially during labor and delivery, because that is what causes you to have your contractions, okay? Your joints start getting more flexible. And that's due to the hormone known as relaxin, which is only produced during pregnancy. Your thyroid hormone goes up, okay, and that T3, T4 levels all go up, and that causes an increase in your basal metabolic rate. Okay, so you have an increased demand of insulin from the pancreas, especially during the first half of your pregnancy. So you want more insulin, you want the pancreas to produce more insulin. Physiologic adaptations occur. In the first trimester, there's a little bit of ambivalence. Do I really want this baby? Do I not want this baby? Or really, I'm not sure, right? There's that little bit of ambivalence. In your second trimester, particularly around quickening, the mother starts feeling much better. And remember also in the first trimester, you're nauseous, you're vomiting, okay? You're feeling really sick, so of course you don't know whether you really want this kid or not, because you cannot imagine 9 months of this, right? So in your second trimester, the nausea goes away. You feel the quickening, and all of a sudden you start fantasizing about the baby, and you start focusing on yourself. You know, you want to eat right, and you're happy, and you feel a whole lot better. In your third trimester, that nesting instinct starts to occur. You know what? 2 weeks before you're getting ready to give birth, you start cleaning the house, right? And you clean it from top to bottom. I mean, I was crawling in the attic. Yep, doing the baseboards and everything. And my husband's going, whoa, what the hell happened here? You know? Yep, doing all the baseboards, just cleaning and doing really, really well. And then you get the whole period of getting it over with. Can we just get this over with? I am tired of being pregnant already. Did we all go through that? Don't want it anymore. Look, I'm done. Okay, and the focus now is on the baby and on the actual delivery itself. Okay. Several of you have come up and asked, exactly what do you mean by a safe and effective care environment? Because apparently some of you have taken the test before and you didn't do too well in that particular area. Well, a safe and effective care environment simply means that you understand what the disease process is of the patient and you can anticipate what problems that patient could encounter. Okay, let me give you an example. If you know, if your patient has a CVA, okay, you know, and with the right residual, okay, which means the right side is paralyzed, right, cannot be moved. You know, therefore, that if you're going to transfer this patient, where are you going to put the wheelchair or the chair? On the left side, right, because you're always going to put it on the unaffected side. So that constitutes safe and effective care environment. You know what to do for a person who's sick. For a person who is blind, you knock on the door before you come in. You use that clock method, but remember, make sure that he understands that, no, the peas are not going to be delivered at 3. Okay, you understand. You just clarify all that stuff to him. You also want to make sure part of having a safe and effective care environment is explaining exactly what it is you mean. I mean, I make jokes of all the mistakes that I made, you know, because they're funny now. They were funny then even, because it's something you learn from. Okay, so if you know that, for example, a patient, that the TIA, a transient ischemic attack, is a precursor or is a mini CVA, a mini stroke, then you know that if someone presents with, you know, the signs and symptoms of the TIA, you know, facial drooping, flaccid on one side, right? If you know all those signs and symptoms, then you know what? And you know that the TIA is the precursor to a CVA, then you know that if someone presents with these symptoms that you got to do something now. You're not going to wait. Yeah? Same thing with your emergency drills and your emergency situation and your disaster situations. Same thing. In the hospital, the emergency is that you got to take care of that particular patient, the sickest patient, right away. So if someone comes in with an MI, I'm getting him back right away. Someone comes in with a possible TIA and a possible stroke, he comes back right away. Okay, so that's taking care of a safe and effective environment. On the other hand, in a disaster area, the safest you can make that environment is to what? Take care of the least sick patient first so they can help you take care of others. That now makes the environment safer. Yes? Okay, good. I'm glad you all follow that. Okay, I was also asked another question about yeast infections. Is it true that you can pass it back and forth to a guy? And yes, a guy can get it. Sure. He sure can. The other thing I want to point out also is that some women every month will have a mild case of candida. Okay, you don't have to rush out and treat it, because if it occurs right before your period, the menstrual flow will actually flush it out by itself. Okay, so if it's a mild case of candida, you don't have to. And this is just for your information. NCLEX doesn't ask you this sort of thing. But it's for your information. If it's a mild case and it's right before your period, leave it alone. Because chances are your menstrual period will flush out the candida. And then that's $23 that you don't have to spend on metronidazole or on monistat. We are going to talk about the antipartal patient. Okay, means the patient right before pregnancy or be, not before pregnancy, but before giving birth. It is usually the pregnancy-related changes that occur to the woman that prompt her to seek health care. Would you not say that? So, I mean, if you're nauseous and you're vomiting and you have no period, that makes you go see the doctor, right? So it's usually the changes that happen to you that make you go see the doctor. Okay, we've got three sets of signs. We've got the presumptive signs, which are subjective. We've got the probable signs, which are objective, and the positive signs, which are diagnostic. The presumptive signs include amenorrhea. We presume you're pregnant if you don't have a period. It's not a definitive. Okay, it's not a definitive sign. Why is it not a definitive sign? Because it could occur because, remember, we just went through all of that? It could occur because your hormone level may be low. So amenorrhea is one of the presumptive signs because it could occur because of, again, a low hormone level. It could occur because of too much exercise. Okay, it could occur because of some drugs that you're taking. It could occur from any number of things. So it's not a definitive sign. It is a presumptive sign. We presume you may be pregnant if you have amenorrhea. Nausea and vomiting is another presumptive sign because, again, it could be because you have a virus. Maybe you've got gastroenteritis, okay? So it could be anything, but it's a presumptive sign. Urinary frequency, having to go to the bathroom very often, that's also a presumptive sign. Doesn't necessarily mean you're pregnant. Maybe you got a UTI. Breast tenderness is another one that's presumptive. Now, I don't know about you guys, but, you know, right before my period, my breasts get real tender. Doesn't necessarily mean I'm pregnant. So that's just not, you know, not a definitive sign. Quickening, yes, even quickening. Quickening felt by the mom is a presumptive sign. It is only when the examiner feels the baby, then it's a different story completely. But quickening, movement of the baby felt by the mom is a presumptive sign. Could be peristalsis. Could be a bad wave of peristalsis, okay? Could be fatigue. All right, probable signs. Probable signs include uterine growth, a big stomach. Again, that doesn't necessarily mean she's pregnant. Could probably mean that she's been eating too many chocolate chip cookies. Okay. Could also mean what? Maybe there's a hydatidiform mole in there. All right, could be anything, again. Chadwick sign, which is that bluish cervix, that's also a probable sign because it means that the cervix is engorged, but other things can cause the cervix to be engorged as well. Goodell sign, which is the softening of the cervix, well, that also that's a probable sign. Okay, the softening of the lower abdomen when the doctor examines, which is Hagar's sign, okay, that's also a probable sign. A positive HCG is not a definitive sign. Positive HCG is a probable sign. Why? Because sometimes you may have a tumor that's producing HCG. Now, I know I said to you that HCG is only produced during pregnancy, and that is correct. However, sometimes you have these tumors that produce a high level of estrogen, which can turn an HCG test positive. Okay, so it could be a tumor. Ballotment, and you know what ballotment is, right? You push on this abdomen, and then you tap the other side, and it bounces back and forth like a balloon. Okay, ballotment is also a probable sign. Again, doesn't mean you're pregnant. A lot of chocolate chip cookies will do that too. Braxton Hicks, which are those false labor contractions. Okay, those also could possibly be from something else. It could be from too much gas. So if you ate a whole head of cabbage yesterday, you might just have Braxton Hicks today. Or at least you might have gas today and think they're Braxton Hicks. But no, you're not going to give birth. Okay, what's the positive sign? Well, positive signs is obviously, number one, fetal heartbeat. Also, if you can actually see the fetus on an ultrasound, that's pretty definitive, all right? Palpation of the fetal outline, that's also very definitive. And it, like I said, fetal movements felt by the examiner. Okay, felt by the examiner, that would be a positive sign. How long does a pregnancy last? 40 weeks. So everyone says, well, that's 10 months then, thank you very much. So we lie to you when we tell you it's 9 months, right? No, we don't, because a month is what, 4.3 weeks. So if you divide 4.3 into 40, then you got 9 months. If a baby is born before 37 weeks, then it's preterm. If it's born after 40 weeks, then it's postterm. If you lose the baby or the baby decides to come out any time under 20 weeks, that is an abortion, okay? The estimated date of confinement, or your EDC, is at the end of the ninth month. Your EDC is always at the end of the ninth month. Remember, the key word is estimated date of confinement. That is the day that we expect you to give birth, though you could fool us all and come a little bit earlier or a little bit later. How do you determine that EDC? Well, that wonderful Nagel's rule. Let's go over it very quickly. Nagel's rule was the same 25 years ago, and it is the same today. It hasn't changed. And NCLEX asks you the same question. Okay, some things just never changed. This is one of them. Nagel's rule, let's determine it. Let's just say that your last menstrual period was July the 15th. Okay, it is now September. So your last menstrual period was July the 15th. You add 7 days to July 15th. Go ahead and do that. What's that now? July 22nd, right? Then you go back 3 months. So July, you go back to June, to May, to April. So now it's April 22nd. Now this is the year 2002, so your baby cannot be born April 22nd, 2002, can it? It's got to be 2003, right? So you add 1 year. If your last menstrual period was in January, February, or March, you don't have to add 1 year. But you understand why you add 1 year. You can't go back. You've got to go forward. This woman's pregnant. Now, how are you going to take the best care of her? Well, you've got to get that extensive health history. You've got to get that extensive obstetrics history. In other words, how many times have you been pregnant? How many babies do you have? All right, we used to use the GPA system, right? Gravida para abortions. We now use the GTPAL system. And NCLEX, yes, it does, uses the GTPAL system. It occasionally will, you'll sometimes will see GPA, but you will see the GTPAL system. G stands, it's in your book, I think, right? G stands for Gravida. T stands for term births. P stands for premature births. A stands for the number of abortions you've had. And L stands for the number of live children you have at home. That's your GTPAL system. I'll repeat it. G stands for gravity, which means the number of pregnancies you've had. T stands for the number of term births. Okay, term pregnancies. P is the number of premature births. A is the number of abortions. Now, whether it's spontaneous or therapeutic, still counts. A is the number of abortions. And L is the number of live children you have at home. Now, why did we go to the GTPAL system? Because it gave us more information. If you've had a history of premature births, premature, okay, if you have a history of that, then chances are you'll be, this baby that you have will also be premature. If you have a long-standing history of, say, you're gravida 3, P0, T0, A2, what does that tell us? That tells us that your last two pregnancies, you lost. So now you're pregnant again. This is going to help us maybe help you along in terms of getting your baby to term. Yes. Premature includes everything after 20 weeks that don't survive. Yes. Because remember, less than 20 weeks is considered abortion. So over 20 weeks is considered premature. You also want to weigh her regularly. Now, we always tell moms, right, pregnant moms, the preferred weight gain is 25 to 30 pounds. Well, that's nice. Yeah. But I got to tell you, there's some women who, you know, they eat carrots and it turns to fat. Yeah, I mean, I took care of one woman. She watched her diet. She ate salads and she just kept ballooning and ballooning and ballooning. So the preferred weight gain is 25 to 30 pounds. We ask you not to gain any more than that. Also, we are going to be monitoring your vital signs, specifically your blood pressure, very frequently. Why? Because we want to make sure you don't get, if you do get PIH, we can take care of you. We can help you out right away. We're going to monitor your urine for glucose and protein. Again, why? PIH, again, possible complication. This is part of your safe and effective care environment. You want to know why you're doing these things, okay? You will do a CBC, we'll do a UA, again, to check, just to follow up. Make sure, again, that your labs are okay, that you're not spilling anything into your urine. We're going to do your blood type. We're going to do your Rh factor, because remember, we got to know. Okay, if mommy is negative and daddy is positive and baby is negative, it's okay. But if mommy is negative, daddy's positive, and baby's positive, might have a problem. You may not have a problem with the first baby, but your second baby will have a problem, right? With erythroblastosis fetalis, which is why any mom that is Rh negative is going to get Rogam. She's no doubt going to get Rogam. And she's going to get Rogam after every single procedure that may possibly cause an introduction of the fetal blood into mommy or mommy blood into fetus. So after every amniocentesis, she's going to get a Rogam. Absolutely. We're also going to do a torch titer. And torch stands for, I'll tell you what it stands for. TO stands for toxoplasmosis. And how do we get that? From little kitty cats. Mm-hmm. I have a cute kitty cat at home. TO stands for toxoplasmosis. R stands for rubella. C stands for cytomegalovirus. And H stands for herpes. So we will do a torch titer to make sure that she does not have any of these, or that she does have at least a titer to rubella. Okay? In other words, that she has some immunity to rubella. If she does not have immunity to rubella, then after the baby is born, okay, we're going to immunize her. We're also going to do a VDRL. What is that? We're going to check and see if she has syphilis. Now, in North Carolina, before you can get married, you still have to have a VDRL. Yes, you still have to. We will do fetal heart tones after 16 weeks, and we will monitor fetal movements in the second and the third trimester. Now, in your book, you've got a story, you've got this chart about the fundal height, you know, where it should be. You just need to look at that. Sometimes they'll do chorionic villi testing. We very seldom do it anymore. We'd rather just wait and, you know, do the amnio at 14th week. A glucose tolerance test is very common as well. And we usually do this on women who manifest some form of symptomology of diabetes or who are diabetic, or maybe who have been diabetic in terms of type 2 diabetes. Okay, so we will often do that. An ultrasound will be done, and that's usually in your second trimester that we do an ultrasound. An NST, which is a non-stress test, or oxytocin challenge can also be done. Now, we don't just do this on everyone. These are tests that you can possibly do. A non-stress test, you know, it's very, very simple, really. It's similar to the oxytocin challenge test. You give them oxytocin, okay, you get a contraction, and you monitor the fetal heart rate just to make sure that you've got the nice D cells in the right place. And we'll talk about D cells and stuff like that when we get to the labor process. Okay. You also want to tell your women, your pregnant women, that they need to come for regular checkups. And they're going to ask you how often they need to come. What you want to tell them is that they need to come monthly up until the 7th month, and then bi-weekly during the 7th and 8th month, and after that they're going to come weekly until delivery. Okay, so monthly up to the 7th month, bi-weekly during the 7th and the 8th, and then weekly until delivery. Your responsibility as a nurse is to explain all the exams and the lab tests. This is part of your safe and effective care environment. That's why I say to you, you may not be doing the test, but you need to understand it, know how it's done, so that you can anticipate possible complications and explain to the patient exactly what to expect. That's part of safe and effective care environment, and that's something that NCLEX is very big on. You got to know the test. You got to know how it's done. You got to know what you're looking for, and then you have to think, okay, what complications could possibly arise from this particular test? You also want to explain to the mother what happens with each trimester. The first trimester, she's going to be green and purple and yellow, every single color under the sun. Because why? Because she's going to be nauseous. She's going to have morning sickness. Well, for some people, the morning sickness starts in the morning and goes all day. And you are just sick as a dog. And they tell you what? Eat dry crackers right before you get out of bed. Yeah, right. It works. It didn't work on me. Tell them they're going to be tired. Now, I told you I fell asleep everywhere I went. Right? First trimester, could not wake me up. I'd fall, just sit, go to sleep. That's it. Wake me up later. I would sleep on the floor anywhere. I was that tired. You will have frequency, you want to go to the bathroom all the time. So the only time I got up out of my sleep was to go to the bathroom. And breast tenderness, so that's your first trimester. In your second trimester, you've got heartburn. And along with the heartburn, you've got constipation. Why heartburn? Because now the baby is growing, it's moving up a little bit in your stomach, and it's pushing against your diaphragm, pushing against your stomach, and pushing against your esophagus. So you got heartburn now. So first you had frequency and nausea and vomiting, and now you got heartburn and constipation. In your third trimester, now again you feel like you got to go to the bathroom. And this is where you get the hemorrhoids. Oh, yes. Because this baby is so big, it is pushing on everything, and that's when you get the varicosities, which is what hemorrhoids are, the varicosities in the rectum. You've got the backache, the leg aches, the insomnia. You've got supine hypotension. You can only sleep in one position. You can all identify, right? You can only sleep in one position. So don't, you know, you tell the husband, don't touch me because I can't move. I mean, if I move, I can't go to sleep. I can't breathe. You also need to tell your patients what are reportable danger signs. Okay, so reportable signs and symptoms. What danger signs does she need to report? Headache is definitely a big one. Now, she's going to have lower extremity edema. Didn't we all get, I mean, everyone here been pregnant one time? Yeah, some no, okay, but most of us have been pregnant one time. What happened to our feet? They got all swollen. They got all swollen. If you stood up for a little, man, they just swelled up. So lower extremity edema is fairly normal, but it's the upper body edema that's a problem. Okay, the upper body, I'm talking the face, the upper arm. So when your fingers start swelling a whole lot, that could be a warning sign, all right? Some women have got, the hands get so swollen that the rings get embedded, and then you got to cut the rings off. But upper body edema is a warning sign. Visual disturbances, another warning sign. What does this tell you? It tells you that she may very well have high blood pressure. Epigastric pain is another sign or symptom of PIH, preeclampsia. Okay? Vaginal bleeding or discharge, definitely a reportable sign. A high fever or abdominal pain. Anytime they stop feeling the fetus moving, anytime there's decreased fetal activity, that's a warning sign. If they become incredibly short of breath, that's a warning sign. There are a lot of pregnant women today who develop congestive heart disease during their pregnancy. Absolutely. I just had she's 32 years old, a little black lady who just developed congestive heart disease. And how did she report it? How did she find out? Well, she walked up the stairs and, you know, just couldn't do anything more. She had to sit down. And so when she reported it to, you know, told her husband said, well, you're pregnant, you walked up the stairs, so you're out of breath. And she says, no, you don't understand. This is different. This is really different. I just don't feel good. Brought her to the hospital, and we did all the checks on her. We ended up having to x-ray her, so we shielded the abdomen, and she had cardiomegaly like you wouldn't believe. So certainly, you know, you can come down with congestive heart disease during your pregnancy. So those are signs and symptoms that you need to report. We'll talk about nutrition during pregnancy now. If we're talking about congestive heart disease, okay, we're going to tell people what? You got to eat good, you got to eat right. Yes, particularly during a pregnancy. Like we said, total weight gain 25 to 30 pounds. So you want to increase your calories by 500 per day. You know that old wives' tale? Oh, go ahead, have three other helpings because you're eating for two. You're not eating for two. You're not. An additional 500 calories a day is ample. But you do want to tell them to increase their iron and their calcium intake, because why? They've got to make the red blood cells for the baby, right? Baby needs the iron to make the red blood cells. You need the vitamin D and the folic acid also for proper maturation of the baby's bones and of the baby's neural system. Protein, you want to increase it by 30 grams a day. Again, why? Because the baby needs to build the body, the muscles. High fiber, why? Because she's already undergoing possible constipation. So take the high fiber so she won't be too miserable. When it comes to adolescent moms need more protein, calcium, and iron than anybody else. What do adolescents tend to eat? Pizza and Coca-Cola. That's good. That got a balanced diet. Well, yeah, but it was a vegetarian pizza. You know, come on now. But you see what I mean? Adolescents tend to not know what to eat properly. I take care of a lot of adolescent moms, And they literally think a pizza supreme, because it's got ham and vegetables, it's got olives, and it's got green peppers, and some of them have pineapple on it, you know, and a pizza supreme, okay, and a Diet Coke is good. You told me not to drink sugar, so they have a Diet Coke. That's good. According to them, that's a balanced diet. Piece of chocolate cake for breakfast covers all the food groups, okay? So this, you got to understand that adolescent moms need special care. These are babies having babies. Yes. These are babies whose bodies haven't completely formed yet, haven't completely grown yet. So their bodies in and of themselves are growing. And now they got a fetus inside them that's also growing. So there's a huge demand on the mommy. So adolescents are a huge challenge, but you know, I think we all need to rise to it. Another thing also is that anyone who practices PICA, you need to counsel them seriously on good nutrition. When I was pregnant, my mother-in-law gave me a sack of flour. Promise you. She gave me a sack of flour. And I'm thinking, okay, she wants me to bake for her. I had no idea what it was. So I take the sack of flour and I put it aside. Finally, after a while, I said to her, you know, what kind of cake or cookies do you like the best? And she says, honey, I don't expect you to cook for me or bake for me. I said, but this flour, she says, oh, no, that's for you to eat. Yeah, because in her family, everyone practiced PICA. When they were pregnant, they just ate flour. Yeah, so someone who practices PICA now has a nutritional imbalance, right? Because they're filling their body with this. Sometimes some people eat clay. Yeah, absolutely. So PICA is the ingestion of some non-nutritious substance. So those are the people you need to be a little bit more cautious of. Complications of pregnancy can occur. PICA can certainly lead to it because, you know, remember, if you eat just a non-nutritious substance, then you're not putting nutrition into your body. So complications can occur, but these complications can be because of the childbearing or because of conditions before the pregnancy. Now, let's talk about some of these complications. We'll talk about complications in the first, second, and third trimester, and then we'll talk about complications that occurred before the pregnancy. First trimester, bleeding complications. Well, if you have bleeding complications in the first trimester, it could be because you're aborting, it could be because of an incompetent cervix, or it could be because of an ectopic pregnancy. Now, when is the prime time for an ectopic pregnancy to rupture? About 8 weeks. 6 weeks sometimes, but 8 weeks is the prime time. Okay? We have people who come in and who complain of left-sided pain, right-sided pain, and they're pregnant, and they're bleeding. Well, right away, we suspect ectopic pregnancy, we put an IV in, and we get them ready for the OR. With an incompetent cervix, what do? Well, with an incompetent cervix, a lot of times we do a cerclage. Okay, you put a stitch into the cervix, and then you put them on bed rest. Now, Sophia Loren, remember that gorgeous, wonderful woman? Sophia Loren had two children, and she has an incompetent cervix, and she had to have a cerclage both times, and she was on bed rest for the full 9 months, both times. So I call this the Sophia Loren technique. There are five classifications of abortion. There's threatened, inevitable, incomplete, complete, and missed. If it's threatened, that means you have some vag bleed and some spotting. The cervix is still closed. The fetus is not expelled at all. So with threatened, it means it's threatening to happen, but it's not going to happen because the cervix is still closed. Okay. With inevitable, the cervix is dilated. You've got contractions, and the vaginal bleeding may be very heavy. So inevitable means it's going to happen, okay, because the cervix is open. An incomplete abortion is when you have the fetus that is expelled and the placenta is retained. This is a problem because it can end up with the mom bleeding to death. She is in excruciating pain. The treatment for this is that you've got to take her to the OR and do a dusting and cleaning, a dilation and curettage. Okay? You've got to do that. Sometimes they'll give you Hemabate, but that doesn't, or they'll give you Pitocin, okay, to try to make your your uterus contract, but really just taking the patient to the OR and doing a D&C is so quick and it just fixes the problem right away. A complete abortion is when all the products of the conception are expelled. So you're talking about fetus, you're talking about placenta, you're talking about the whole kit and caboodle. A missed abortion is when the fetus dies in utero and is retained. This requires a D&C, okay? There are situations where a woman can get pregnant, does her first test for pregnancy, and it is positive. The baby is fine until a certain point along, and then the baby dies, but the mommy doesn't know that the baby has died, but the baby dies, okay? And she's still retaining, she doesn't expel that fetus, she's still retaining. Now, this can all occur in the first or second, first trimester, still retaining, but, you know, nothing's coming out. So, you know, next month comes along, still no period. Next one comes along, still no period. All right, so she thinks the pregnancy is progressing perfectly fine until she goes for a test. And then she finds that her HCG level is low. Her quantitative HCG is low. Okay, quantitative means the exact number. If at 4 months, it should be at a certain level. At 3 months, it should be at a certain level. So at each particular month, it should be at a certain level, and your HCG levels should be rising. So sometimes they find out because they go for the test, and they find that the HCG level is very low. And so, you know, the doctor says, well, you're 6 weeks pregnant. She said, that's not possible. I'm 4 months pregnant. And I'm 4 months pregnant because 4 months ago I was told I was pregnant. Well, the HCG level says that you're 6 weeks pregnant. So do we have a problem? We do, because the chances are there's fetal demise, okay, and it's being retained. And this one also requires a D&C. What are some of the nursing interventions that you need to implement on a patient that is possibly going to abort? Well, number one, you got to do that peri-pad count. And here's the thing, you've got to be very specific. NCLEX asks you, you know, to say that you're going to do a peri-pad count. I'm telling you that in your nursing practice, what you need to do is you need to ask the patient not just how many pads they have used, but how many pads have they saturated. In other words, completely saturated. And why is this? Because some people get one spot in the pad and they throw it away. And other people use it till it's soaking and heavy and then they throw it away. Okay, so you need to find out. You need to standardize it and say, how many have you completely saturated? Okay, so you want to do a peri-pad count. If she is in an inevitable abortion situation, everything that comes out, all the tissue that comes out needs to be saved. Don't throw it away. You need to also prepare her for a D&C because she may very well need one, and certainly a lot of emotional support. She may have contractions, she may not. She may have low back pain, she may not. But it's your job to just help her along. Okay. We talked about the incompetent cervix. Let's talk about ectopic pregnancy. Well, with ectopic pregnancy, it's usually a one-sided pain. You got vaginal bleed. Okay, the HCG, like I said, is dropping. Okay, not going up, it's dropping. And she may have signs and symptoms of shock. If the fallopian tube has ruptured, now sometimes the NCLEX says to you that she has severe pain. Well, I'm here to tell you that sometimes they don't have severe pain. Just a couple of months ago, I had someone come in who had an ectopic pregnancy that ruptured. She was in no pain at all. She was just in because she was bleeding, and she'd been bleeding for 2 weeks. And she couldn't figure it out. Turned out she had an ectopic pregnancy, and it had ruptured, and she just was not in any pain at all. So, but NCLEX says pain. So you know, right, the answer is pain with ectopic pregnancy. You want to prepare this person for surgery, and you want to control shock. Okay, some risk factors for ectopic pregnancy. Well, we talked about STDs, yes? We talked about a history of PID, which is STDs. We did talk about IUD usage. Intrauterine device. Okay, intrauterine devices have a tendency to cause more infections. Remember I talked to you about that? And the more infections that you have, the more chances that you have of ectopic pregnancy. So that's why the IUD is falling out of favor today. Endometriosis can certainly cause it, and any abnormal structures of the fallopians as well. Non-bleeding problems in the first trimester. Well, number one is hyperemesis gravidarum. Okay, hyperemesis gravida, which means what? Lots of vomiting. Well, I had a 19-year-old come to the ER. You love my little teenage stories? A 19-year-old come to the ER, and her big complaint was, you know what? She was pregnant. She was vomiting. She had nausea and vomiting. She came to the ER for that. I said, honey, did anyone ever tell you that this comes with being pregnant? And she said, yeah, I know, but I didn't think it would be this bad. Okay, so she was not in the hyperemesis situation. I mean, a certain amount of nausea and vomiting certainly comes with being pregnant, especially in the first trimester. We're talking now not just the normal nausea and vomiting, which is what this girl had. We're talking hyperemesis gravidarum, which means she cannot keep anything down. So she now is dehydrated, and she's now very, very sick. And so she ends up with an IV in her arm and Phenergan. Okay, this is a bad, bad problem. Second trimester, well, the hydatidiform mole that we're talking about, this, as we know, is a proliferation of cells, okay, and it's the degeneration of the chorion. It's a grape-like cluster. We talked about Rh incompatibility as well. When if mom's blood is, mom is Rh negative and daddy's Rh positive, right, then if that happens, we have to give mom Rogam. The third trimester, we've got six, placenta previa, placenta abrupto, hypertensive complications, cardiac complications, endocrine complications, and preterm labor. These are the six problems that we're going to cover in the, as far as third trimester problems are concerned. Placenta previa. Placenta previa is when the placenta is low. It should be high up in the uterus, but it's low, and it can either partially cover the cervix or completely cover the cervix, or it can just butt up against the cervix, okay? With placenta previa, what you have is painless vaginal bleed after about the seventh month. And this is diagnosed with an ultrasound. Mole tips are very prone to having placenta previa. Anyone with uterine abnormalities or anyone with a past history of uterine surgery. So what does that mean? It means moms have had C-sections. Moms with C-sections have more of a tendency to have placenta previa. Okay, how do we treat it? Bed rest. Put him to bed. If we have to do a sterile vaginal exam, basically anyone who has a vag bleed, you do not do exams on. You don't do a vag exam on. You let the doctor do it, and the doctor will do it with a speculum. You'll do a peripad count. You'll monitor those fetal heart tones, and you will put the mom on the fetal monitor as well. Okay, prepare for a C-section, and you're going to watch that H&H. Those fetal heart tones need to be watched carefully. Placenta abruptio. Placenta abruptio is when you have a sudden separation of the placenta from the uterus. There was a 38-year-old woman who at 5 o'clock in the morning felt a sudden sharp pain to her abdomen. Okay, a sudden very sharp pain. It lasted for about a minute and then it went away. And after that, she did not feel her baby move. She felt her baby move very, very quickly after that. So sharp pain in her abdomen for about a minute. Then she felt the baby moving around real, real quick, and then the baby stopped moving. She called her doctor. This is 5 o'clock in the morning. Doctor says, I'll see you in the office at 9 o'clock in the morning. Just come in at 9 o'clock in the morning. Okay. But she didn't feel really comfortable with that. Okay, so she came to the hospital. She presented to the hospital around 6 o'clock. At 6 o'clock, she showed up. We put her on the fetal heart monitor. No fetal heart tones. Okay? None. None at all. Nothing. She had had a placenta abruptio. The placenta had suddenly separated from the uterine wall. Now, what the baby did was, it was a sudden episode of now hypoxemia, right, for the baby. So he was moving around real quick because he was in distress. And then all of a sudden, boom. As soon as he stopped moving, he was dead. Right. Mal tips have a tendency to have a higher risk factor for this. People who have substance abuse like alcohol or any kind of drug. What are your interventions if you suspect it? Well, every 15 minutes you're going to take vital signs. Okay. You're going to put the mother on the fetal heart monitor, which is what we did, but it was too late. Left side lying position. We're certainly going to give a lot of TLC. And we get ready for a C-section. Though, I mean, you know, placenta abruptio occurs so fast. You want to watch for a problem called DIC, which we discussed the other day also, disseminated intravascular coagulation. And if that when you have a mom with a possible placenta previa or possible placenta abruptio, what you want to do is have these fibrin products ready. Now, she can have a partial abruptio, not a complete abruptio. This woman had a complete one. Okay, so you can have a partial abruptio. In that case, then it's certainly worthwhile to, it's certainly okay to monitor the mom. But remember, she is going to go into the OR. All right. The biggest problem that we have today is PIH. It's a huge complication, and it's accompanied by proteinuria and edema. There is an area in the United States called the toxemia belt. Okay, and the toxemia belt is Kentucky, Tennessee, West Virginia, Virginia, North and South Carolina, Georgia, Mississippi, and Alabama. Well, darn. Do you see a trend there? It's all the southern states, right? That's called the toxemia belt. PIH used to be known as toxemia. What happens is we don't know why. Nobody really knows why PIH develops. We have hypotheses. We think it develops because we've tried to link pica to it. We can't really link pica to it. We've tried to link a high-salt diet to it. We really can't link a high-salt diet to it, though it puts you more at risk, but we can't really link it. Okay, so we're not quite sure exactly what it is that causes PIH, but we do know that there is that belt where it is more prevalent. Okay, with PIH, you've got three phases. You've got mild and we've got two phases. Three, actually, mild, severe, and then you've got the eclamptic phase. So in the mild phase, you've got edema to the hands and the face. You have a hypertension, which is where the systolic is 30 plus 30 and the diastolic is plus 15 over the baseline. So let me give you an example. Let's just say that your patient has a baseline of 110 over 60 as a blood pressure, okay? And now her blood pressure is 140 over 90. Would that be a mild PIH? Yes, it would, because the diastole is plus 30, the systole is plus 30, and the diastole is plus 15 over. She also will have proteinuria of plus 1. Now, plus 2 is not good, but if she has a headache, or epigastric pain, we got a problem. So anyone with PIH comes in complaining of a headache or epigastric pain or visual disturbances, that is a problem. You need to put them immediately on bed rest, put an IV in them, and just get ready. Because we don't want them to go to eclampsia. Eclampsia is when they have the seizure activity. This is when the level of consciousness changes and they may go into a coma. Labor may be precipitated. I can tell you a story as a student nurse. As a student nurse, I was assigned a patient. Nobody told me she had PIH. Nobody told me this. This was during my labor rotation, and this was at the Medical College of Virginia in Richmond, Virginia. All I knew was that she had gone in for a C-section, and now all they wanted me to do was monitor her after the C-section and just take her vital signs. Okay? That's all they wanted me to do. They told me she was going in for a C-section to take care of a problem. They didn't tell me what the problem was. And I'm a student nurse, so I'm not going to ask any questions because I don't want to bother the real nurse, right? So I didn't ask any questions. I had come a long way since. But she was taken to the OR to take care of a problem. So now she's out, and now I have to get her blood pressure. Well, the old cuff thing, right? I pump it up, and I pump it up to 200, and I don't hear anything. Isn't that odd? So I wait a while because I know that I'm supposed to wait, so I wait a couple minutes and then I pump it up higher. I pump it up to 300 now. Well, at 300, it's coming back a blood pressure of 280 over 190. And I'm thinking, no, it can't be. Can't possibly be. So I take the cuff off, put it on the other arm. Put it on the other arm, pump it all the way up to 300 again, and it comes back at 260. Okay, over 140, 150, something like that. I'm going, no way, how can that be? Take it off, go back to the first arm, because, I'm thinking to myself, I've never seen blood pressures like this before. nobody can have this. So by the time I'm getting ready to pump the third one up, she sits up and goes, and she's seizing. She's seizing. So student nurse, and at that point in time, they made us wear caps. Student nurse, big cap on the head. Can you picture this? eyes as big as saucers going, help! Okay, I mean, that's all I could say. The nurses come flying in from who knows where. I mean, at one point, there were no nurses, and all of a sudden, there are nurses coming in from everywhere. They pull me aside, and, you know, I'm like, yank. And they start taking care of her. Well, it turns out that she had PIH. They took her in to surgery because the cure for PIH is what? Delivery. Okay, you deliver the baby. And generally, you deliver the baby, and everything gets fixed. But her problem was so advanced, they delivered the baby, took her out. Now, don't you think it would have been nice if they told me she had PIH? Yeah, but they didn't. So anyway, she seized, you know, and one thing led to another. Next thing I knew, I was just sitting there on the floor going, oh, gee. And my cap was over on one side. I mean, you know, I was just, oh, it was terrible. What a picture. So generally, surgery takes care of PIH. I mean, not surgery, but delivery takes care of PIH. Sometimes it doesn't. So your interventions, right, with PIH, right? You know, I told you already, right? Bed rest, monitor, watch the mom and the baby. Daily weights while she's still ambulatory. Eyes and nose, seizure precautions. And you might want to give mag sulfate, or you want to give a Presylene. And certainly, like I said, you fix it by how? You fix it by C-section, deliver the baby, okay? And what you try to do at first is just control it with meds. And you try to control it with everything you possibly can. But if that none of that works, then you've got to deliver the baby. Now, what does mag sulfate do? 2 days ago, I said I wasn't going to cover magnesium because I was going to cover it here, because essentially, really, the only times you get asked questions about magnesium is in the labor and delivery section. So let's talk about it here, okay? Magnesium, mag sulfate, diminishes the neuromuscular transmission. So it calms it down. And it promotes maternal vasodilation. So as secondarily, what does it do? It drops your blood pressure as well. It's also an anticonvulsant. So if I said to you it diminishes your neuromuscular transmission, would your reflexes be up or down? It would be down, right? So one of your nursing responsibilities would be to check for deep tendon reflexes. So you got to come in with that little reflex hammer and be banging on knees, okay, to see if they've got any reflexes or not. And they should still have normal reflexes. You want to make sure that you still see normal reflexes. If the reflexes are diminished at any point in time, or if there's clonus. Okay, what's clonus? Any one of you guys ever wake up in the middle of the night and your feet are just cramped over like this? Yes? You've got a sudden cramp, your foot is like this and you can't move it? That's clonus. Okay? That's what it is, clonus. And that occurs because the neuromuscular transmission is so low, okay, that it seizes, really, it catches, and it can't release, okay? So what's the antidote? Well, any time that you're giving mag sulfate, you need to have calcium gluconate on hand. It's rather like when you're giving Coumadin, you should have vitamin K, and if you're giving heparin, you should have protamine sulfate. If you have giving mag sulfate, then you need to have calcium gluconate on hand, okay? Now, NCLEX also wants to ask you about one other drug. If you're giving digoxin, you should also have digibind on hand. Digibind, that's the antidote to digoxin. I'm here to tell you, digibind takes 3 days to work, so it doesn't matter whether you give it right away or give it, you know, another day from now. It doesn't really matter because it takes that long to work. But NCLEX wants you to know that you should keep digibind on hand should you have a patient with digoxin. Digoxin also has mild diuretic tendencies. Okay, so that's another NCLEX question. I just kind of throw this in because we're talking about dig. That's another NCLEX question. Your patient is on digoxin. Which of the following should you watch for? And the answer is hypokalemia, because it has mild diuretic tendencies. Back to labor and delivery. We'll talk about some endocrine problems. Gestational diabetes can occur to women who've never had problems with glucose or insulin metabolism before. And this can be due to changes that occur in that glucose insulin relationship as the pregnancy goes on. So, you're going to identify risk factors. How do you do that? Well, you ask the mom, you know, when you've done the GTPAL, ask if she's had any large babies in the past. I took care of a little lady from Guatemala. She was about 4 foot nothing. because she was this tall, really small. She was this tall, and she was kind of rotund, the Guatemalan look, you know? Really cute lady. This tall, she had the little Guatemalan look, and she'd had like four babies before. And this baby was big. It was a big baby, and so, you know, she didn't speak a word of English. So through a translator, I asked her about her past babies. And I said, you know, how big were your other babies? She had babies that were 10 pounds and 9 pounds. And my baby was 4 pounds, 11 ounces, and I thought I'd given birth to Hercules. You know? Can you imagine? She's this tall. 10 pounds and 9 pounds? I'm thinking, dang. But anyway, right away, what does that do? It tells me, well, gee, maybe she's a gestational diabetic and she doesn't know it. So right away, you know, you've got to monitor her. You could check the blood glucose and stuff like that. And then you have to end up possibly putting her through a glucose tolerance test because she's at risk. Okay. The other thing is that you want to ask any fetal demises. In other words, when you do the GTPAL system, you get an idea of how many live births this person has had. Because if she has a history of prior fetal demise, then she may very well have had gestational diabetes before and just not known it. This puts her at risk. Also, are all your babies at home healthy? Okay, are any of the babies born with congenital anomalies? I had a patient who had four babies at home, and this was her fifth. Okay, and of the four babies, two are born with a cleft lip, one was born with a cleft palate, and another baby was born with a cardiac valve problem. So she had four kids at home. Now, she came from another country. All of these kids didn't have repair. So they all had the cleft lip and the cleft palate. Yeah, none of them had repair. So remember, she came from a very, very poor country. Okay, so none of them had any repair. And so right away that tells me what? Well, that tells me, well, gee, you know, maybe I need to explore this a little bit further because she's now at risk for gestational diabetes. So what we did with these people is then we scheduled them to come in for a glucose tolerance test. And we generally do that around the 24th week. We tell them nothing by mouth before the test. And then when they come in, we give them this nasty, horrible, icky, sweet thing to, well, anyone ever had that GTT? Nasty, huh? And we tell, right, I know. Then you draw the blood, and then you drink the stuff, and then you draw the blood 30 minutes after, and then you draw the blood an hour after, and then you draw the blood an hour and a half after. I mean, you're just drawing blood all the time. Okay, but what we're trying to do with the glucose tolerance test is really to ascertain how well the pancreas is responding to that high carbohydrate concentration that we just put into her. We're also going to tell her about dietary restrictions. And we're also going to tell her what? If she does become gestationally diabetic, that she may need sub-Q insulin. Or that she is diabetic already, we may need to up the dose. Now remember, when you're pregnant, if she's taking glucophage or metformin or any kind of PO hypoglycemic before her pregnancy, the second she gets pregnant, she needs to stop them. She goes on insulin. And the reason is because all those PO hypoglycemics, metformin, glucophage, glucotrol, I don't care what, Avandia, they're all teratogenic. Okay, they can all cause problems with the baby. They cross the placental barrier. So they do not, absolutely, you do not give any PO hypoglycemics to any mom during their pregnancy. They all have to switch to insulin. Okay, also understand, now, I honestly don't know how this little Guatemalan woman gave birth to that 10-pound baby. She must have had, like, stage 4 lacerations. You know what I mean? That poor woman. Whew. Big old baby. You just prepare them because generally these babies that are born to diabetic moms are pretty large. And so then this condition called cephalopelvic disproportion could occur, CPD. And if the head is too large and it cannot pass through the pelvic cavity, then we'll do a C-section. I had a mom one time. She insisted that she wanted a normal vaginal delivery. The baby was 12 pounds, okay, and she was pretty small, but she insisted that she wanted a normal vaginal delivery. Well, baby's head engaged, okay? And after, I think she was hitting her 30th hour of labor, and she was really exhausted. The baby's head was engaged and right there, but could not pass through the canal. she was determined. After the 30th hour of labor, she gave in. Okay, we took her to the OR. Let me tell you what I had to do. Had to put gloves on, had to put my hand up the vagina and push on the head while the doc was trying to pull the baby out because it was that stuck. Yep, that's CPD. So you don't want to get to the point where you can't get it out. Okay, you really don't. You really, really don't. All right, what are some of the effects of diabetes on the fetus? Well, macrosomia, we all know this, big babies. We call them the immature giants, don't we? Big babies. Congenital anomalies, fetal demise. If the baby is born to a diabetic mom, you need to monitor the mom's blood sugar after birth, but also the baby's blood sugar after birth. And generally, it's 30 minutes after birth, then 1 hour. And then it's 30 minutes, 1 hour, and then it's the 1 hour, and then 1 hour again. So you do about four of them. So you have to monitor the baby's blood sugar level after delivery. Most hospitals have the same protocol, you know, where you monitor 30 minutes after birth, and then another 30 minutes after that, then 1 hour after that, and 1 hour after that. Some hospitals, especially in very high-risk areas, will do 15 minutes times two, 30 minutes times two, and then 1 hour times two. So it kind of depends. Just watch your hospital policy. Another risk or complication of diabetes for diabetic moms is spontaneous abortions. Okay? Now, remember we talked a little bit earlier about cardiac complications on moms? Okay, this is a very real problem, a very real problem. A lot of it has to do, I believe, with the type of diets that we have right now. I mean, I think it's in the water, but no, maybe not. Maybe it's in the air we breathe, I don't know. But essentially what I want you to know, I'm going to go through four classes, and I want you to know these four classes, and I'm going to give you little stories to help gel these things along. Class one is there's no limit on activity. You've got cardiac problems, but you can still continue to walk. You can still continue to do whatever it is, normal daily functioning, okay? Class two is when you have a minimum limit on your activity. In other words, you can walk to the top of the stairs, but you have to stop at the top of the stairs because now it's tiring, okay, to catch your breath. Class three is that you have problems climbing to the top of the stairs. You cannot get up one flight of stairs. It's very exhausting on you. Class four is when you're sitting down, not doing anything, and you've got discomfort at rest. Do we take care of moms with cardiac problems who are pregnant? Absolutely. Can we also cause a cardiac problem on a mom? Absolutely. We had a mother come in. We were monitoring the baby. Now, she had had a lot of problems getting pregnant, so she went to see this incredible perinatologist in West Palm Beach, brilliant doctor, also very gorgeous. And we would call her. There were two perinatologists in West Palm Beach, and get this, they were both women, they were both from Jamaica, and they were both gorgeous. And we would really get very upset because, you know, we'd call them in the middle of the night or 2 o'clock, and they'd show up looking gorgeous, and we'd go, excuse me? Can you just go out and, like, ruffle your hair, please? You know, don't come in looking so good. Anyway, she had this incredible perinatologist, and they found out that the baby had AFib. This was a fetus. And this perinatologist diagnosed AFib in the baby. Isn't that incredible? It's incredible. So how do we treat AFib in an adult? We give DIG, don't we? Well, guess what? DIG crosses the placental barrier. So we have to give it to the baby. So guess what? We gave it to mom. Okay? And we gave it to mom and we gave it to mom. And that was good, but we had to monitor mom now. Because we gave it to the baby and we fixed the baby's AFib. But guess what we gave mommy? First degree heart block. Yeah, I know. It's a shame. But, you know, this is the risk that she had to take. She had to choose the risk. So we fixed the baby, but we gave the mommy something. But it ultimately, you know, the mommy will also get fixed. But so we can, you know, we give things as well. Nice little presents. Signs and symptoms of cardiac complications. Now, you all know this. Okay, difficulty breathing, right? Edema to the lower extremities, palpitations, orthopnea. What is orthopnea? You can't sleep laying down. So what's a good question? How many pillows do you sleep on? Right? So if you ask how many, and they say four pillows, you know they're sleeping in a pretty upright position. Yeah? So that means what? They have severe difficulty laying down to go to sleep. Okay? You also want to know, did they have any shortness of breath? Yeah, all those questions. So how do you treat a mom, a pregnant mom, who's got a cardiac problem? Rest periods, certainly, lots of rest periods. You want to monitor the vital signs as well. You may have to increase cardiac meds, but if you do so, you have to monitor baby as well, very carefully. Because remember, a lot of these cardiac meds do cross the placental barrier. A low sodium diet, and tell them left side lying. Okay, why is that? Because remember the superior inferior vena cava, all right, go back into the left side of the heart. During labor, that person is going to be on oxygen all the time. You may need to use forceps. I know that forceps are going out of favor, but with this particular instance, you don't want to labor her to labor too much. You want to get that baby out real quick. Okay, so they may need use forceps for this. In the postpartum period, these moms can breastfeed. They can breastfeed. No, I'm sorry, they cannot breastfeed. Cannot. They cannot breastfeed. Okay? We do ask them to be on strict bed rest. They cannot breastfeed. We'll give them stool softeners, and we may give them prophylactic antibiotics. Alrighty. I had talked to you a little bit earlier about adolescent pregnancies, and I'd said to you that these were babies having babies. It's very, very true, because physically they're not completely developed. Psychologically, they're not completely developed either. I tell you what's the most crying shame. The most crying shame is when you have a 13-year-old who is pregnant, okay, and she goes to school and she's pregnant, and all her little 13-year-old friends run around her and go, "I am so happy for you. Congratulations." Hey, she is not giving birth to Barbie doll. This is not a doll. This is not a toy, but they don't understand that. It is now a status symbol. Yes, this is where our society has gone. Let me tell you, I was in a high school in Florida before I moved up to North Carolina. Went to a high school to do a talk on adolescent pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases and HIV. There were three kids in that were pregnant, big pregnant. And everyone was around them going, "I am so excited. What are you going to name your baby?" Yeah. Not a clue. Not a clue. They are psychologically at risk, let me tell you. You want to talk to these adolescent kids, okay? Talk to them. Ask them, do they know what it takes to bring up a baby? And a lot of times, this is what I hear. Okay, I always wanted something of my very own. This is not a pet. Right? I always wanted something of my very own. I always just wanted something to love me. Okay, get a dog. But I mean, it's absolutely unbelievable. That's the one side of it. The other side of it is she's 13 years old. She's 13. So who's the guy who got her pregnant? Where is he? Okay? This is statutory rape, folks. No matter how you look at it, it's statutory rape. She's 13. I know that in Mississippi and Alabama, 13 is the age of consent. Did you know that? You can have sex in Mississippi and Alabama at the age of 13 years old, but you cannot go cane fishing with a pole because that's a felony. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's true. It's absolutely true. I know these things because I get on the internet and I research these things and I'm like, no way. Yeah. Yep, that's a fact. Okay. So anyway, she's 13. So where's who's the wonderful young man who impregnated her? Oh, but he loves me, Mommy. Don't tell the police. Okay. We've got 13-year-olds. Now, here's the law, folks. If you're under 12, okay, and the perpetrator is 4 years older than you, it's a first-degree felony. It's a first degree. That's 25 years in jail. All right? If you're over 12, then that person has to be at least 6 years older than you. Now, this is in most states, not all states, okay? Some states, like I said, Mississippi and Alabama, it's different. So if you're over 13, then that person has to be 6 years older than you are. No, I'm wrong. If you're under 13, if you're 12 and under, 2 years older, and that's the first degree. Okay? If you're over 14 years, and there's a four-year difference, that's a first-degree felony. If you're 16, then it has to be a six-year difference and a degree felony, and that's 25 years. Okay? So the unfortunate thing is that the majority of these 13-year-olds and 14-year-olds and 15-year-olds become pregnant because of some form of sexual abuse. Okay, now, I don't care how you look at it, whether this 13-year-old said, yes, you can have sex with me or not, that's still sexual abuse because it's still rape, it's still statutory rape. She's 13, she doesn't have any right to say yes or no. She has a right to say no, obviously, but she doesn't have no right to say yes. She's 13. That is still rape, that is still sexual abuse. And you all need to get that to your head and understand it and spread the word. It is rape. And rapists, anyone who dares to have sex with someone underage should be sent to Ithaca. You know, I mean, what, The Rock, everywhere, I don't care. I have other things I'd like to do to this person, but I'm not going to talk about it. Okay. Yeah, you too, exactly. So that needs to be made very, very, very clear. It is sexual abuse. It is rape. Okay, it is against the law. It is unacceptable. Absolutely unacceptable. Lots of these teenage girls are in total denial. Okay, they don't understand the reality behind being pregnant. They don't understand the reality of what it is to have a child. Okay, they think that having a child is very cute. They're going to run around with this cute little thing that they can dress up in pretty frilly little stuff, right? And lovely little clothes, and they don't understand that this is a 24/7 job. Okay, the second night that they can't sleep because the baby's waking her up in the middle of the night, or the second night that she's now got to change the diaper six times. You know how it is? You change the diaper, baby poops, you change the diaper, put the new one on, and guess what? Blah, there he goes again, right? We all know this. You got to change the diaper again, right? Yes, we know this, and it happens all the time. Very unrealistic expectations. They don't understand that this is normal. They don't understand this at all. Okay, they don't understand the normal development of a child. They don't understand that at 9 months, that you cannot do this to a child. I saw this happening with a little teenage girl. She had a little baby. Okay, and the baby was about 9 months old, and she had this piece of candy in her hand. First of all, candy, no. But she had this piece of candy in her hand, and she would do like this to him. Here, you want it? Jamal, you want it? And every time the baby would reach for it, she'd pull it away. Yeah, she says, you want it? Come get it. Here, you want it? And every time he reached for it, she'd pull it away. She didn't understand what she was doing. She thought she was building courage and strength in this boy. She didn't understand that what she was doing was actually teaching him, don't try for anything. You're going to fail anyway. She didn't understand that.
Please move to the next section of the lecture series.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to help support the podcast, please share it with others and leave a rating. We wish you all the best in the coming examination. See you next time.